My notes tell me that we have members of a moot court team, the Sail and Light moot court team. If they're here, will they stand, please? And from Waukesha County, are there others here from Waukesha County, too? Ah, very good. Well, thank you very much for coming. Please be seated. The Sail and Light moot court team. Could someone take 2 minutes and just tell me what?
Sail and Light is our local club. We operate under the national NCSCA, which stands for the National Christian Community.
Very good. Thank you, and thank you for coming. Well, if you all can stay after this argument, Justice Daniel Kelly, who sits down here on my left, will come down and chat with you all a little bit about how cases get to the Supreme Court and I'm sure answer many questions. We won't be talking about the substance of the argument that we're going to hear today, but there are a lot of other things I think you'll find interesting if you can stay. So, on to the second case of the day. Lang versus Lions Club. Are you prepared to proceed, counsel? Please do.
Morning, everyone. My name is Neil Schellinger. I represent the defendant, respondent, petitioner, Fried Audio, and their insurer, State Farm Fire and Casualty. What I intend to do is highlight a fact that might not have been highlighted that I think will persuade you that Fried Audio is indeed an agent of the Lions Club. Then I'm going to discuss two cases that have been cited frequently which deal with fundamental fairness. And when we review those two cases, I think the conclusion will be that Fried Audio is entitled to recreational immunity under the statute. Both the respondent plaintiff and I have put into our appendixes the contract between the Lions Club and Rhythm Method.
And in fact, was with a booking agent, wasn't it? I thought it was with a booking agent.
It was with the booking agent, but
it was for the services of Rhythm.
Correct.
Okay.
And so the booking agent is acting, obviously, as an agent for Rhythm Method. And Rhythm Method is made up of its members, which Fried Audio LLC is one of the members. And in that contract, it indicates that the purchaser, which is the Lions Club, of the performance or performers, is telling the performers in what would be amount to paragraph 6 that the performers shall do everything necessary to prosecute the work in an expeditious and workmanlike manner and pursuant to the standards of the trade. They also indicate that the band leader shall, as agent of the purchaser, meaning the Lions Club, enforce disciplinary measures for just cause and carry out instructions as to selection and manner of performance. In other words, by contract, the purchaser, Lions Club, is retaining a right to control the members of the band. And why is this important? It's important because, as indicated in Maddox versus Hochgreave, a case where one would look at it and say, the Mason, who had absolute control and exercise of control of the masonry work, was actually found to be the agent of Hochgreave, because Hochgreave retained the right to control the actions of the Mason.
Would your argument be the same if Fried was not a member of the band? Let's say this was a situation where, I mean, I understand what you're saying, the contract between the band and Lions Club, but this was a separate activity that had to do with the sound system. What if Fried wasn't a member of the band and he was just hired by the band to then perform that task? So is he an agent of the Lions Club? Isn't he maybe an agent of the band but not of the Lions Club unless he's an agent of an agent?
Well, that's what he would be, because the Lions Club is delegating authority to the band to do and prosecute the work necessary. And that leader of the band is the agent of the Lions Club by virtue of this contract. And therefore, he can delegate to any member of the band or anybody else.
So you're saying it doesn't matter?
No.
Even if he wasn't a member of the band, it's irrelevant to your argument?
Not in this circumstance. And that would also encompass some of the arguments I made later on in my original brief regarding people can have multiple hats when they engage in different activities. But for purposes of this case, under these facts, that contractual provision is extremely important, and it shows that there is a retention of control, which is significant in determining whether or not there is an agency relationship.
Does the fact that Fry formed a separate LLC to do audio work affect your agency argument? That is, making your argument is that he is an agent of the Lions Club.
No, because he is an agent of the band. He's a member of the band.
Yes,
the LLC is a member of the band, and according to 183.083, they are all agents of each other, the entire member of the band.
How is the band managed? Is it member managed, or is there a managed? Is management vested in one or more managers?
My understanding is that it's member managed.
And you say, is that a part of the record?
No.
Does it make any difference if it, in the analysis that the court has to undertake, whether or not it is member managed or if it the LLC is managed with management vested in one or more managers?
I don't believe so, because this particular contract is for the performance of the performers.
As I recall, and I don't know if I can pull it up right away, when I was going through the transcripts, there was some reference when your client was testifying, or this, Mr. Is it Fried?
Yes, Your Honor.
Was testifying that he also, he has a lot of good equipment, that he also does this for other bands. Is that correct?
I know this particular band has two different bands. I'm not sure of the reference, if he was referring to Light Up and Rhythm Method.
It was the Light Up band that I remember a reference to, but I'm a little...
They're the same members. They just perform a different set. Light Up is a... It's an 80s, 90s band. I can't remember the name off the top of my head.
But is that a separate LLC?
Light Up, I do not know, and I didn't make that part of the record, Your Honor. Focusing particularly with Rhythm Method.
In looking at the complaint, does the complaint, in your opinion, state a cause of action against Fried Audio LLC in the capacity of independent contractor?
I believe he is not an independent contractor, because what he was doing, the task that caused the injury, he was a servant, and he was a servant of the Lions Club.
I'm asking about the complaint, and as you interpret the complaint, what's your interpretation of the complaint? Is it making a cause of action, and it's kind of a notice pleading complaint, but does it make a cause of action against Fried Audio LLC? as an independent contractor, as a member of Rhythm Method, or both?
The complaint was not that specific, Your Honor. And when the insurance company hired me to defend them, I looked at it as they either were an employee or agent of, could be the Lions Club. That's why I brought the motion for summary judgment in the first place. And that the specific act of laying a cable on the ground between the mixer and the band and the power cord is something that was part of the condition related to the property and the premises. And the original complaint was for safe place violation and negligence as it pertained to the property. Because of that, Your Honor, I believe the recreational immunity statute applies and applied under Carini.
Yeah, though as I recall, I'm picking it up now, the complaint had a couple of causes of action, and one was safe place. Is that correct?
And one was,
One was the safe place?
Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, that was one. That was the, as I recall, the second of the two causes of action. I may be wrong, but the first one was just, I think, good old straight negligence. Am I correct or incorrect?
I would have to review the complaint to determine the order, but one was good old negligence and the other was plain old safe place.
Okay, but regardless of the order, both were pled. Is that correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And you don't know whether or not the order is, as I indicated. And you don't know, as you stand here, whether or not you're defending Fried Audio LLC as an independent contractor or as a member of the band?
I am defending specifically Fried Audio LLC as his involvement in laying down the cord and as a member of the band, because the LLC is a member of the band. So in both capacities, I am defending Fried Audio LLC.
Is
there anything in the record that I missed that addresses the issue of compensation for doing the sound work to your client?
There is nothing in this record that the court has before it that addresses that issue.
Okay, and I don't want to hear it, but I... is it a reasonable assumption that if you're going to go through the effort to form a separate entity? By the way, I was quite impressed with the deposition testimony because your client kept on correcting the lawyer as to what an LLC means and membership and principles. But isn't it a reasonable assumption that if someone is going to form an LLC, that they do so for some reasons of compensation also?
I think that a reasonable assumption would be that sometimes in the course of musicians getting together, one musician, because of his real job during the day, might be more concerned about being sued. And as a result, they form an LLC to protect themselves.
For the liability, you think?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And yet, LLC is also the Rhythm Method. They are an LLC.
That is true, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Counsel, if your argument about agency is correct, that makes the contracts of specific interest to us. So can you tell me where the relevant contracts are? And the reason I ask is because your brief says the contract between with Lions Club is at pages 39 and 96 of your appendix, and I can't discern that from those pages.
Sure.
Can you tell me what those contracts are at 39 and 96? Because they're not the same, are they?
Correct.
Okay.
You will find one of the contracts at the appendix of the appellant at page 40 and the other at the respondents at page 118, and I have to say that the copy is much clearer and easier to read than mine, but it's at page 118 of that appendix.
Isn't it 117? I thought the one we're talking about is the Sunday performance, which is $4,000. At 118, it's the $3,500, which I thought was the Saturday performance.
The both of the contracts are exactly the same, Your Honor.
Yeah, except for the amount
in
of
wording.
Money.
Yes. So one is for August 4th and the other is for August 5th.
Okay, and looking at this contract, because you started out talking about this paragraph that was very important, and that's the one starting, the performers shall do everything necessary to prosecute the work?
That one and two paragraphs lower where it says the leader shall, as the agent of the purchaser, enforce disciplinary measures for just cause and carry out instructions as to selections and manner of performance.
Okay, but that has nothing to do with manner of performance. So that, what does that have to do with the sound? I mean, this doesn't tell us what the obligations were to lay chords or whether there was sound needed at all. Perhaps they wanted to just go, you know, the projecting method and not use any sound. I mean, where in here do we see these specifications that you're saying show the control?
All right. That's a good segue into the two cases that deal with fundamental fairness. The application of specific directions or a reasonably precise control, which was discussed in Westmiss, which relied on the Musan case, which in turn relied upon the state of Lyons, is very specific. If we go back and remember what agency is, agency applies to tort liability where the principal is liable for a servant's act. Our Sand case made it very clear that sometimes those words are used interchangeably, agent, master, servant. And they said in order for a principal, such as Lions Club, to be held liable for the performance of their agent, that agent must be a servant. The cases relied upon in Westmiss relied upon the estate of Lion. You have to remember, and in these cases involved independent contractors. Westmiss involved an independent contractor. And so the question really comes down to is, are they an agent? Is Fried Audio an agent? Or are they an independent contractor? The estate of Lyons dealt with the fundamental fairness of the principle that an independent contractor stands alone. So in other words, the principal is not liable for their torts, correct? However, fundamental fairness requires that under a certain circumstance, an independent contractor, when will it be just to find that immunity applies under a governmental immunity statute? And in Westmiss, as in the estate of Lyons, everything that the contractors were doing or the architects were doing required highly specialized knowledge. They would not have been immune because of that independent contractor status. But what they ended up looking at is if the right to control remained with the Department of Transportation in the Lyons case, then the immunity afforded was found to also apply to the contractor. They looked at that and said it's just fundamentally just because under these circumstances the governmental entity is retaining and is actually directing what they do.
Counsel, what did your client, what was the scope of services that your client to the band?
I'm sorry, say that
again. What was the scope of services that your client provided to the band?
He basically lugged a lot of the equipment around, and then he set up basically a console up front. He then plugged in the power where the power was needed and distributed the power to all the different requirements. Then when the performance actually went on, he would have been controlling whether that guitar was louder, softer than the guitar over here, the drums, etc.
So could the Lions Club have said, hey, no, we don't like the volume of the guitar here, to go turn that down, or otherwise, you know, told your client how to set up the whole sound system in general beyond the plugging in?
I think yes. You know, this is basically a family event, so if all of a sudden they came there and started doing some sort of offensive rap music, that contract clause basically says, hey, you're going to follow our instructions, and whichever one of you band members want to be the leader, you're acting as my agent, and you're going to do what I tell you to do.
Is a copy of the noise variance permit anywhere in the record?
I do not believe so.
Counsel, when you talk about instructions, and when I went through the transcripts, I mean, I see Mr. Miller, who was from the Lions Club. He was their liaison person. I think it would be correct to state, maybe even had a title, maybe chair of the festival, but he was the one that we're focused on, if I recall.
It was divided by two, between two people, Burse, who actually signed the contract, and Frank Miller, who they shared duties, they divided it up, they delegated whatever they were going to do.
This is the testimony that was presented in the appendix of the petitioner, and I'll read a couple, because appendix is page 71. The question was asked, did you require your musical acts to take the same steps when they're placing wires inside the beer tent? And the answer was no, in 2012 we did not. Why not? Answer, the sound companies who were providing services to the bands weren't contracted by us, so we did not get involved in how they set up their equipment. And as I go through this, first of all, let me ask as an aside, who was the sound company contracted to? Does the record reflect, since this states they weren't contracted to the Lions Club, who were they contracted to?
The sound company that would be referred to in this case is Fried Audio LLC, Your Honor.
Yes. Is there a contract, oral or written, that exists between the band and the Fried Audio LLC?
There is no written contract, Your Honor. They're all members of the band. They're all friends, and this is just how they evolved.
Okay. On page 77 of the appendix, when Mr. Miller was asked, with whom do you interact from Fried Audio, he said, I don't know the names. The question, tell me about those interactions. And the answer was, we discuss which stage they're going to be playing on and show them the power panel that they have access to for the equipment. Question, and is that power panel that's on the pole on either end of the stage tent? And the answer was yes. In the deposition testimony of the client, and I don't have that marked at the moment, but he said that he didn't get directions from anyone. And I look at appendix page 78, question to Mr. Miller. How about in 2012, did you have any prohibitions or specific instructions or directives as to how they're supposed to run their wires from that soundboard in the middle of the tent to the stage at that time which they're performing on? And the answer was, no, we didn't. So when I go through the appendices, and in the other appendices, plaintiff's supplemental appendix on page 126. It said, "No festival tells me what to do." And he wasn't just talking about this festival, lest it sound a bit assertive. He was saying, no festival gives me these kinds of instructions on page 126. On 132, your client testified that there was no contract between Lions Club and the Audio LLC. And on page 135, testifies, you didn't expect that Cudahy Lions Club was going to tell you how to set up your equipment, did you? Answer, no. I don't expect that somebody's going to tell me that. So don't those all go to the issue of the kind of control that you're advancing that existed here, but the deposition testimony undermines that?
No, I disagree with that.
Okay, tell me why.
And the reason is this. There are some times where the relationship is so long-standing, you know what to do. And everybody has been doing this. This festival has existed for 14 years. All these people, for the most part, have been there before. Once you do something once, you don't need to be told again. It's the same as when you're told, you know, a property manager or apartment owner tells the property manager, shovel and salt. You don't go any more specific than that.
Well,
you know, one of
the record and the transcripts that were provided me in the excerpts, and there are some that are just excerpts, pages are missing, but in the appendices, there is no indication that Fried Audio LLC was ever given any directions as to set up by the Lions Club.
But it's the right to control. Who had the right to control the grounds? The Lions Club. Who was in possession of the grounds? The Lions Club. Who assigned someone to go around and look for trip hazards? The Lions Club. Who put mats over exposed cords when they saw it? The Lions Club. You know, the bright blue cord that was laid down between, as you see in the thing, you know what? Everybody just probably thought, hey, that's open and obvious. That's the way we do it. That's the way we have always done it. No one has fallen before. Now that someone has fallen, what do they do the next year? They say, you got to put them up overhead. They retain the right to control. Maybe they didn't exercise it. Just like in the cases that I cited in my brief, you don't micromanage all the time, especially when there are functions that have been delegated time and time again. And that's the whole purpose of Maddox and Holgreave. That's the whole purpose of the Geise case, the Himes case. Carry a bucket of water. Okay. Take the faucet over there and bring it over here. You don't micromanage and watch them and then they spill. There are certain things that are so simple and so obvious that you don't need directions. You don't need specific, reasonably precise specifications. And this is one of them. It's something that they have done so often before that they still retain the right to control. They just never exercised it. Just like in Maddox versus Holgreave.
Okay, thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Anthony Skemp, and I represent the Langs in this matter. And if you'll indulge me for a moment, I am the third generation of my family to stand in this grand courtroom and argue to this prestigious body. And it is I'm very humbled and honored by the opportunity to do so. In preparing for the argument today, I decided to, because I do believe, and I hope the court agrees, that the issues involved have been adequately briefed, I wanted to highlight six points, talking points. And those six talking points are, number one, the applicability of the Lew case. Number two, what I call the legislative acquiescence. Number three, this allegation in the briefs by Fried Audio that the Court of Appeals somehow established a brand new test. Number four, that Fried Audio, in fact, is advancing a whole bunch of new tests that they did not do at the lower levels, that they did not advance. Focusing specifically on the fifth one, that's this concept of a simple task involved in simply plugging the cord in. And finally, this issue that Mr. Schellingo touched on about subsequent years. And so I think that the court is aware that the issue of occupier is out. The sole issue here is the issue of agency. And I think Mr. Schellinger conceded that in his reply brief at a footnote, specifically saying that the only issue is agency. And why that's important to the first point is because the Liu analysis upon which he relied at the trial court level, upon which he relied at the court of appeals level, and upon which he included in his briefs at this level, are included in one paragraph of the Liu case, and the Liu case is an occupier case. That's the only issue in that particular case. So I would submit that this commonality of purpose wherein he tries to juxtapose Cudahy Lions Club and Fried Audio to be comparable to the two snowmobile clubs is inapplicable to this case.
Could you add to your 6 points the right to control?
Absolutely, and that, Your Honor, is going to fall under the issue of this whole concept of simple task, because Mr. Schellinger advances the argument that anybody can plug a cord into an outlet, and because we plug a cord into an outlet, we have adequate control of the premises. And I submit for the court's consideration that that is not the analysis. As this court did in Westmiss, they looked at the issue of not only the right to control, but the control and what that means, taking a look at the means and the methods, taking a look at whether specialized skills are involved, taking a look at whether any specific directives were in fact advanced. All of those things go to the issue of control and the right to control. And in this particular case, as Your Honor correctly pointed out in the testimony, Fried Audio not only had substantial control, Fried Audio had exclusive control. There was zero evidence in this record from Cudahy Lions Club that they had anything to do with the setup.
Could they have?
That's an interesting point, Your Honor.
Well,
absolutely.
I think it's interesting because our cases speak in terms of control or the right to control, right?
Correct.
Okay. So let's talk about the right to control rubric. Is there anything in the documents that indicates to us that no one but Fried had the right to determine how the wiring was accomplished?
There's nothing in written contracts. I mean, it's the testimony that shows by the conduct of Fried that he alone was the individual who had the control.
Right.
But
that tells us factually that he controlled it. The question is whether anyone else had the right to control.
I would, in answering that, if I may, Your Honor, Lions Club, it's their event. So certainly they could have the right to control. They could have the right to tell the carnival operators how to operate their carnival rides. They could have a right to tell the food vendors how to operate their food and what to sell. But to say simply that because they're the organizer, they have the right to control, now we're getting into limitless immunity. Now we're getting into something that this court had already established in the Roberts case when it looked at immunity is not limitless. And so if we're going to end the analysis at they're the organizer, they had a right to control, that's it, that's the end of the inquiry, then I think what we're doing is we're abrogating Roberts.
Well, Roberts dealt with the question of whether the hot air balloon company could be considered an owner or occupier, right?
That was the issue that this court asked for additional briefing on, yes.
So, and we didn't address the question of whether there was agency there.
That is correct.
Okay. Yeah. But here we're dealing with a question of agency. And agency is where we come into the question of control or right to control, right? So tell me why, as you have already said yourself, that the Lions Club had the right to control. Why is that not dispositive of this issue?
Because this court went beyond that in Westmiss. That's a factor to take into consideration when they're making their determination on the issue of agency. It's not dispositive. If we review the Westmiss case, they look at reasonably precise specifications, and they look at what means and methodologies were utilized.
And where did we come up with the authority to say that we must look at the means and methodologies to determine whether there was a right to control?
I believe that this court analyzed the issue of agency because it was an issue of first impression. And so the court went back and looked at the principal-agent relationship and looked at the courts outside of the context of recreational immunity, how they've defined agency.
Right. Well, we went to governmental immunity, didn't we?
For the Showers case, yes.
Okay. And under governmental immunity, we're not looking at precisely the same thing when we're talking about the agency relationship. There we're talking about the exercise of discretion, right?
Correct.
Okay. How does that relate to this?
Well, this, in terms of agency, in the context of recreational immunity, Westmiss was the first case that defined agency within this context. So one of the things this court utilized in helping reach its determination was out in another governmental immunity, in another immunity case, the governmental immunity case, they utilized Showers to help determine the issue of control. And this reasonably precise specifications in Showers in the governmental immunity, as Your Honor is aware, said that you can't have either the right to control or control if you don't establish reasonably precise specifications. And Mr. Schellinger makes the argument that the Court of Appeals in this case relied exclusively on that in reaching its determination.
But we weren't talking about control. We were talking about exercise of discretion, weren't we, in governmental immunity,
yes.
Okay. So how does the exercise of discretion equate to the right to control?
I think that goes to what I had discussed before. In discretion, you have the right to say whether you're going to do it or not. It's discretionary. In agency context, however, you've got to specifically identify the procedures. You've got to specifically identify the means and methodologies. You've got to provide guidance. You've got to provide instruction.
But if you do all that, then aren't you effectively exercising control? And aren't you then conflating control with the right to control?
I would, yes.
Okay. Shouldn't we not conflate those two things?
No, because this court has already spoken on Westmiss that you don't conflate those two things. That the opinion in Westmiss essentially looked at Creekside's relationship with the conference point and looked at the issue of the means and methodologies, the specialized skills involved, certainly Conference Point had the right to control their property. So I would think that it's an opposite to this particular case, Your Honor. And, you know, one of the reasons that...
Well, if agency can be established by either control or the right to control, how did we preserve that distinction in Westmiss?
I would submit that this case is on identical grounds with Westmiss. So
it very well may be, but what I want to know is, did we preserve the distinction between control Westmiss?
I don't believe that you did.
How did we do that?
Because you established the things that that the right to control incorporates things like reasonably precise specifications, incorporates all these other things that I had mentioned when you're determining whether they exercise that control.
So, yes. So how is that different from actually controlling?
But they didn't control in this. So if you ask how...
I know. That's the problem. I'm trying to find some daylight between control and the right to control. And it seems like what you've just told me is that in Westmas, we said the right to control is control by virtue of providing all of those elements that need to be included before you find a right to control. So I'm trying to figure out how, if we've just completely conflated those concepts in Westmas, or if there's still any actual distinction between them.
In the recreational immunity context, I don't believe there's any distinction between them. Because remember, this was the first case that the Supreme Court, during the roughly 30-plus years of recreational immunity statute being around, that the Supreme Court addressed the issue of agency because it's not defined in the statute. And that brings me to this legislative acquiescence, which I believe is an important point to make.
Let me just ask you this. In Westmas, we concluded at paragraph 38 that no facts were presented supportive of the conclusion that Conference Point either controlled or had the right to control the work. I don't see that as changing the law at all. Do you?
I would say that it didn't change the law. It defined the agency relationship and what is required. And I don't think that simply...
Control, actual control, or the right to control.
And that gets back to the issue of the right to control. If we're going to simply say that they had the right to control, that's the end of the inquiry.
I want to talk to you just for a moment about that. When the application was done here, and it's found at the petitioner's appendix 107 is where it starts, it is done with the county, and then at 109 it talks about amplified sound, and then requires a noise variance permit for all amplified sound, and then goes on at the actual application, page 114, to discuss the fact that they are requesting permission to have amplified sound, and then it indicates a municipal noise variance is permitted. It talks about the responsibility of the event organizer to provide the electrical requirements to support the event. It talks about the event organizer's requirement that amplified sound comply with Chapter 47 of the ordinance. The amplified sound must be directed away from residents. And I'm just wondering, with those specifications, does that affect in any way your argument that you make as to whether they had the right to control anything with respect to the sound provided for the band?
No, because it's addressing not just the musical sound, it's addressing the sound at the beer tents, the sound at the carnival. And remember, Your Honor, that this whole concept of sound requires a specialized skill that Cudahy Lions Club, there's no evidence in this record that they have any background or knowledge as it pertains to sound. This is not simply plugging in a cord into an outlet. This is Fried Audio bringing its own distribution box, plugging that distribution box into the outlet, from the distribution box running cords to other areas, one being to the mixing console, putting the mixing console in front of house in an adequate position in order to maximize the sound, then running cords from the mixing console to the stage, to the amplifiers, to the speakers, to the microphones. And
you're saying the sound that they're talking about with the noise permit and the speakers is with respect to beer tents?
No, it amplifies. I don't know what's going on in those other places. I don't know if there's amplified sound. There's nothing in the record to suggest that in the beer tent or in the carnivals that there's amplified sound.
I just bring it to your attention because specifically it says, please describe the purpose and plans for amplified sound, colon. And then there's a spot for DJ, not checked. Band, checked yes. Type of music played varies 50s, 60s, 70s. Number of bands, 8. So I'm just wondering if you think the application has anything to do with the noise permit, the application, the promises made between the event organizer and the county regarding amplified sound and the bands?
I think that the county is directing the Cudahy Lions Club as to the sound. Amplified sound certainly pertains to the bands, as Your Honor just read.
I didn't understand your, I thought your answer before was carnivals and beer tents and things like that, not bands.
Well, what you just read clearly shows that it pertains to the bands. I don't have the contract in front of me.
Thanks.
So some of the earlier questions referred to Westmas, and as you know, we had a lively dissent in Westmas that emphasized its perceived infirmities in the majority opinion, which I joined. And, of course, the right to control was discussed quite a bit in the dissent. But another thing in the dissent states in paragraph 68, it says, that is to say, there is nothing in the contract to suggest that Conference Point ceded the right to control activity taking place on its property. That's in paragraph 68 in the dissent. You were just focusing on the contract between Milwaukee County and the Lions Club, and I want to focus on the appendix page 117 of the same brief. And this is between the entertainment company and Rhythm Method, LLC. And it says in bold, sound and lights by band. Is that any reference of seating activity and authority as referenced in the dissent? That is, the dissent again says there's nothing in the contract to suggest that Conference Point ceded the right to control activity taking place on its own property. And when I read the contract between the entertainment company and Rhythm Method, and all it says is sound and lights by band, that seemed to me that arguably that is ceding authority of regulating the sound and lights to the band.
I would agree with that characterization.
You might agree with it because it sounds favorable to you, but does it really make sense?
Well, it makes sense because they don't because the Cudahy Lions Club and that Your Honor that shows the Cudahy Lions Club has zero knowledge as it pertains to setting up sound. They're delegating that to Rhythm Method, certainly important to the Cudahy Lions Club from Mr. Miller. Because Mr. Miller said, the reason we didn't get involved is because we didn't contract for it, as Your Honor appropriately pointed out.
I want to know about your complaint, and I want to know the status of Fried Audio LLC. Of course, I know that it is a member of the Rhythm Method LLC, but it's also a separate entity in LLC. The cases referenced when you talk about Westmas, you know, these are independent contractor cases. So what is it? Is it or one, the other, or both? Is the Fried Audio LLC being sued? It's not clear. As a member of the Rhythm Method LLC, or as an independent contractor who also does work for other LLC bands?
Well, first of all, I was the lawyer, Your Honor, that didn't quite understand the whole concept of businesses and corporations and things like that that Your Honor referenced before. They were sued as an LLC, okay? They were, and here's the distinction. Steve Fry individually is a member of Rhythm Method. However, he has set up his separate LLC. So there's the interplay. There are two separate LLCs. I sued them both, and two separate attorneys appeared on behalf of Rhythm Method and a separate attorney, Mr. Schellinger, appeared on behalf of Fried Audio. They did not have one attorney alleging that they are the same entity, and I will submit that Mr. Schellinger did not advance those 185 argument at the trial court level. The first time it came up was at the Court of Appeals level, like with a lot of his other arguments, the simplified tasks, and all of these litany of multiple hats, and a long-standing relationship. They're not there. They're not at the trial court level. They're not at the Court of Appeals level. They're not even in the petition for review.
Well, in the circuit court, it seemed to me when I read the circuit court's opinion in part, he was referencing the occupier argument and relied on the occupier argument and said that you didn't need any degree of permanence. It could be short as a couple of hours. And that's what the circuit court relied on, and as I recall. And, of course, that was still argued in the Court of Appeals, but I know it is not being argued here any longer.
Yeah. That is correct, Your Honor. They went to the issue of occupier, and the trial court didn't even examine this court's pronouncements in the most recent Roberts. So you're right in that respect. That
Counsel, if I were to ask you to assume that the band is an agent of the Lions and Fried LLC is an agent of the band, would the recreational immunity under that supposition that would flow to the band also flow down to the LLC? Why or why not?
I don't believe so, because I think that it's two separate analysis. I don't think that there's reflexive under the law that just because the owner occupier or the owner in this case, Cudahy Lions Club, has an agency relationship with Rhythm Method, and Rhythm Method has an agency relationship with Fried Audio, ergo, Cudahy Lions Club has a relationship with Fried Audio. I don't think that's the case, especially on this record, where they've relinquished, I would say that they've essentially abandoned any right to control because they did nothing. They essentially left Fried Audio to their own devices to set up these cords, the injury-producing cords.
Why didn't the Lions Club cover up the cords? They had a right to cover up the cords, but they didn't do that.
They didn't do that in 2012.
No, they didn't.
They didn't.
Why not?
They did it on the perimeter, and this is where Mr. Schellinger says they had a right to cover up cords and they had a right to put mats down, but in terms of setting up for a gig, for a musical gig, they acknowledge that this is outside of their bailiwick. They don't know what they're doing. And so
you can see a cord on the floor, and I would know, and I'm not anybody ever was involved with sound, and if I wanted the place to be safe, I'd likely cover them up. We cover our cords up all around the Capitol.
And that's a great point, Your Honor, is they say that they did walkthroughs. But you're absolutely right. If you see a cord, especially when they're running cords overhead from the beer tents, you would think if they're really doing a walkthrough and they're really covering up cords in other places, they're going to say, cover these cords up.
Right. Why
they
didn't they cover them? Well, maybe the Lions made the mistake.
Because they're not doing what Mr. Schellinger is saying they're doing, because they've relinquished anything to do with the setup of the sound in that tent.
The setup is different than just covering cords that are lying on the ground, isn't it? I mean, setting up the sound system has to have a certain amount of expertise, I would imagine.
Exactly.
Right, right. But covering up cords on the ground certainly does not. I mean, they have to have the cords running to the stage, obviously, if they're going to have the mixer in the back of the room. Now, most of us wouldn't know how to run a mixer, but most of us could see a cord on the floor and think it was a hazard that should have been covered. And the Lions did a walkthrough, so why wasn't there an obligation to cover up the cords?
They didn't do a walkthrough. That's my point. There's no evidence in the record that they did a walkthrough. They're saying they did because it was their normal course and normal habit.
Did they cover up cords elsewhere?
Yes.
Did they cover up cords anywhere in any tent?
I don't know the answer to that question. I certainly know that there is testimony in this record that they did utilize mats to cover up some cords by the electrical substations, especially because that's where the biggest power source was. Mm-hmm. And they also ran cords overhead in other tents of the festival.
So let's say, you say that the Lions Club gave up and ceded all right to control what Fried Audio did, correct?
Correct.
All right, so let's say a representative of the Lions Club is walking through the tent and he sees that Fried Audio, against all reason, has decided to use uninsulated cords. And there they are on the floor, sparking and jumping all about. And Lions Club guy says, well, nothing I can do about it. Is that true?
No, I would certainly think that the Lions Club guy would know when they're sparking cords that you got to do something about it, but that's not what happened here. These are cords laying on...
No, hang on. Don't go so fast. I can't keep up. So Lions Club guy sees the cords sparking and jumping about on the ground. Can he go to Fried Audio and say, cover that up or use different cords?
Yes.
Okay. Doesn't that establish the right to control?
Under those facts, I think that, as I had indicated before,
the reason I use that example is because it highlights that this is a question of right, not fact, right? So you say that under those facts, then he has the right to control because it's so but the obviousness of the problem has nothing to do with the right to control, does it?
No, I concede to Your Honor that Cudahy Lions Club has a right to control everything that happened at this event. But that leads to the limitless immunity. As I said before, the carnival, they could tell if there's an injury to the carnival, somebody on the carnival ride, simply because they plugged in their carnival ride into the same electric circuit provided by the Cudahy Lions Club, and because the Cudahy Lions Club had the right to control, that carnival, for their active negligence, would be immune, and that's not the intent of the statute.
Isn't your concern with limitless liability a policy consideration for the legislature?
Well, with respect to the legislature, however, they have acquiesced to this court's determination of a third party like Sundog not being an owner.
Counsel, we have previously said that legislative inaction does not necessarily constitute a conscious endorsement of a statutory interpretation. And Justice Scalia, in the Johnson case years ago, went through the multitude of reasons that a legislature may not act in response to a court's interpretation of a statute. So I think that's kind of a slim argument.
Well, all I'm relying upon is, and I don't know the case that Your Honor is discussing with respect to Justice Scalia, but I do have the quote from this court's holding in the Ryder versus Dykin case from 1980, where they specifically say that legislative acquiescence in or refusal to pass a measure that would defeat the court's construction is not an equivocal act. And that with it, especially when it pertains to intent. And remember, in the Roberts case, the issue of intent or it was determined that the legislative intent of this statute did not apply to third parties who have no involvement in opening up the land in the first instance. That's this court's interpretation of legislative intent. So if you'll stick with me, this particular this particular case says the legislature is presumed to know in the absence of its changing the law, the construction put upon it by the courts will remain unchanged. For the principle of the court's decision, legislative intent is a historical fact and hence unchanging. Thus, when the legislature acquiesces or refuses to change the law, it has acknowledged that the court's interpretation of legislative intent is correct.
More recently, in the Wanky case from 2004, we said numerous variables unrelated to conscious endorsement of a statutory interpretation may explain or cause legislative inaction.
Okay.
And we've also said in Kalal that legislative history is, well, we rarely refer to it.
My argument, Your Honor, is that Roberts came out in 2015. This court's decision in Westminster came out in 2018. This court determined the definition of agency because it wasn't in the statute. The legislature did nothing. This court made the proclamation in Roberts that a third party like Fried Audio, who has no involvement, I see my light is on, may I continue?
You may finish your thought.
That has no involvement in opening up the land in the first instance, cannot be a property owner. Because it defeats the legislative intent. If a third party cannot be a property owner under legislative intent, then my submission is they don't get in through the back door through agency what they can get in through the front door. This court has spoken that they cannot be an owner because they're a third party. And I submit that therefore they can never be a third party. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Just hitting on that very last point, you would be completely rewriting the statute if Roberts applied to this circumstance. And Roberts was very clear as an occupier and agency was never addressed. The statute is also very clear that there is an owner and there are definitions for owner, and then there are agents, officers, and employees of owners. And therefore, he would like you to rewrite the statute to write out agency, which would be inappropriate.
Counsel, I wanted to just talk briefly about just this agency piece. If I pay a 12-year-old kid down the street to come mow my lawn, is that child an agent? And under what circumstances would that child be my agent?
The child would be your agent slash servant. The whole problem that came out of Westmiss is that people are not, as it's being interpreted, they're not catching the distinction that was made. It applied to an independent contractor with specialized knowledge. And that's where fundamental fairness came in or doesn't come in. It holds alive and well, Westmiss holds alive and well the concept that if you control the actions or have the right to control the actions, that person is an agent.
So just to flesh that out, just to make sure I understand your argument, because presumably if the 12-year-old came on my lawn and I said, hey, don't mow over there, and I had the right to do it, your position is that the 12-year-old is my agent in those circumstances. Doesn't matter what my contract says. Doesn't matter if I just say, hey, just keep my lawn clean. I'll pay a certain amount per month or something like that. That person is my agent.
When you throw in, doesn't matter what the contract says, I disagree with that, because a contract can redelegate different authorities and or responsibilities. But in your circumstance with a child, he's simply a servant who is a person employed by a master to perform services in his affair, whose physical conduct and the performance of the services is controlled or subject to the right to control by the master. Simple definition under Ryan versus Wisconsin Department of Transportation, 242 Wisconsin.
What if I don't give him any instructions and I just say, I have a friend, a 15-year-old who has his own little LLC and runs a little lawn care business and gets some business to keep it clean. And I just, keep the lawn mowed. If I just pay him a certain amount per month, I don't give him any instructions or anything like that. Does that affect the analysis anyway?
No. Okay. You don't have to give specific directives. Mm-hmm. It's only if the person is an independent contractor, as in Lyons. You had an architect, and the court was basically saying in Lyons, what's the rationale for holding it to be unfair not to provide immunity, which is the exception, liability is the rule. When is it fundamentally unfair not to provide immunity to someone who normally would never have it because they're an independent contractor? It's how the liability flows between agent versus independent contractor. And so when I look at Westmiss, it was very clear that they left open, not only is it the right to control, but the ability to control. And given the cases that were actually cited and digested and dissected, Kublitz, you're talking about a doctor who has his own professional judgment. When they went back to Lyons, the architect.
Yes. The concept of agency involves a fiduciary relationship, right? It establishes a fiduciary relationship. And I think about this in the context of an attorney, where obviously there's a fiduciary relationship that's formed for some things, but not necessarily everything the attorney does, right?
True.
Imagine if I'm riding, I'm a client, and I'm riding with my attorney to an argument, and my attorney gets pulled over for speeding. I may have hired him to defend me. He might be in the middle of defending me in that respect. I might be paying him by the hour for the drive. Am I liable for the ticket?
No. Because you don't have, if he's driving, it's pretty well standard that in general, unless you have some control or right to control.
What if I said slow down?
You might just be a social host who's just sitting there and concerned for your own safety.
Will you explain why Fried is not an independent contractor? I know that's the end of your time here, but is this okay if you can answer?
If it's a short question, but, we want to be fair to both sides.
Why is he not an independent contractor? Because there's absolutely no specialized skill or line on the ground. And because it's a condition of the property, which the property owner is responsible for, and which he could have been told, cover it, cone it, hang it. And as I put in my reply brief, when asked, do you think they should have been you to cover it or responsible? Yeah, it's their event. It's too simple to not be. There was no specialized skill. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Thank you both for very interesting arguments. We're going to take a break now for lunch and come back at 1:30. Students, if you can stay a little bit, Justice Kelly will be down. We are adjourned.